Alan Kring Productions in association with Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 21, delivered on November 5th.
Tonight, cost of capital. Before I begin, just a quick look at the markets. Up day, down day, what do you say, sir?
Overall, it's pretty up, except for the S&P.
It's actually pretty much kind of a mixed picture. Nothing spectacular on anything. The NASDAQ was just barely up, Dow a little bit, S&P down somewhat. It was, again, one of those quiet days on the street. A little bit on the positive side, although the S&P had a sell-off. They all had. Notice something interesting here. This is the S&P. Notice you had that bull spike there in the early trading, and then it just dropped off a cliff and then bounced back. At the end, there was a downstroke on the S&P. If I go back and have a look at the Dow, the same thing happened on the Dow at the end. That downstroke, you see it? And then on the NASDAQ, again, that not as much of a drop-off, but still something of a drop-off. Even the Russell, again, that slight stroke downward at the end kind of indicates to us that, well, something soured the market there at the end. If you'll see, gold was down, which means that investors were pulling out of gold. Looks like a lot of that money went into the bond market. So bond prices moved upward nicely, which of course means that the yields, overall yields were going down. So that's positive news for the economy. Probably the most important thing early trading was simply that the San Francisco Fed released a statement that the interest rate cuts are over. There's not going to be any more of those unless we get something really, really bad happens. We're getting too close to, we probably are beginning to see the first indications of expected inflation beginning to seep in because we put so much liquidity to try to keep a catastrophe from happening over the past month or two, just dumping money into the federal funds market. That can't be good for the long-term inflation expectations. So we're getting into a box here where we're going to slide into a recession, and the Fed will have very little room to try to stimulate the economy through cutting interest rates anymore, because that's been done too much already, and there's not much more room to do that. Moving to what is tonight's subject, however, I'm going to take you on the journey through cost of capital. Now, some of this I have brought a few of these points up before, but whenever the company has money, that money comes at a cost. Whether it's money that comes in through revenues, that costs money to do that. And at the bottom line, everything, there are all these costs too. We divide the capital into several components. The broadest is the distinction between debt and equity. The lenders to the corporation are debt, the owners of the corporation are equity. This is one of the most fundamental of the differences between accounting and finance, as far as equity goes. Accounting, profit is a wonderful thing. Definitely, we wouldn't argue with that in finance. However, when we see profit in our concept of profit, that is a cost. It is just as much of a cost as buying something for your company, something physical. So profit for us is just another cost of operating because we owe that money at the bottom line to the shareholders. And those shareholders, we can either give it to them as a dividend or we can reinvest it back into the corporation to hopefully grow the corporation. But one way or the other, equity is a cost to us. as is debt. Now, debt, that's kind of a broad term. There's a lot of different kinds of debt. But typically we say that the cost of debt, we find the cost of debt after taxes, because we get to deduct the interest we pay on debt from our tax bill. So the after-tax cost of debt is the before-cost tax of debt times 1 minus the tax rate. So that's our cost of debt. Now, there are different types of debt, and I'll mention that here in a minute. However, right now, the corporate tax rate has been flattened out from a tax act just last year, no, a couple of years ago, to 21%, dramatically down from what it had been before that, and certainly much less than what it was many, many years ago before you were born. But we brought it down. The top marginal tax bracket for corporations used to be 39%, and the White House and the Senate and the House, which was at that time controlled by the Republicans, just completely dropped the tax rate, the highest tax rate on corporations, down to a flat 21%, which is a large reason why we are now running $1 trillion budget deficits year over year, nearly $1 trillion. We just can't get enough, we just don't have enough tax revenue to pay for running a government, a modern first world leadership government. So we've got this nice low tax rate for our corporate friends at the expense of what will be your responsibility to pay off someday. It's going to be your problem paying off this candy that we just handed out a few years ago. Notice, interestingly enough, though, an odd thing. When the tax rate was dropped like that, the after-tax cost of debt actually becomes more. Because if I'm taking like 1 minus 0.39, that's 0.61 times the before-tax cost of debt. But now that it's 21%, now it's 1 minus 0.21, which is 0.79. So in other words, R sub D after taxes is now larger than it was before that tax cut. Oddly enough, the weighted average cost of capital, as a consequence of this giant, massive tax cut, has actually risen to the extent that companies use debt in their capital structures. Sort of perhaps an unintended consequence. Ultimately, what that will mean is that companies will begin to shift toward equity and away from debt, because debt has become relatively more expensive than equity has. Understand that under normal conditions, no matter what, equity is going to be a costlier way to finance than debt is. It just costs more. Debt is cheaper than equity as a rule, first of all, because debt is safer, because you have to pay the debt holders first before you can pay the shareholders anything. And second, it's cheaper because we get to deduct the interest expense on debt, and we don't get to deduct dividends from equity. So there are two reasons, broadly speaking, why debt is more attractive than equity. But we have made it somewhat less more attractive by lowering the tax rate on debt, on corporations from what they used to be. Taking that aside, a little problem arises in the cost of debt. The simple way how to find the cost of debt. The easy way, and also the wrong way, is to just take the coupon. Use the coupon on the debt. Okay, this company's coupon on its long-term debt is 5.5%. Okay, that's your cost of debt. And then you take the 1 minus the tax rate, that's your after-tax cost of debt. Very easy to do it that way, and also wrong. Simply because I'll give you an example here. ZBT 4.50% 2032 is currently quoting, oops, at 98.25 on the 100. You see, when this company issued that debt, let's say it's 20-year debt, they would have issued it in 2012. At that time, the investment bankers went to potential investors, lenders, and said, okay, we want to get $1,000 for each of these bonds. What coupon rate is going to do you want so that this will happen? At that time, the investors, the potential investors said, we would expect to get 4.50% and then we'll pay $1,000 per bond. We'll lend the company $1,000 per bond. Well, that's great. However, that changes over time. That what the investor ZBT could actually become riskier. That's one way. And therefore, the investors would expect more from coupons now, but they can't get that from this because it's a fixed coupon. Or the entire economy could have changed and interest rates could be different now from what they were in 2012. One way or the other, what we need is the yield to maturity. That's the current component cost of capital. That says what investors would want now for that same bond. So to do that, I just bring up the, and you've already done this, and it's not a complicated thing. All I do is say, okay, apps, finance, TVM solver. Okay, 2032, that's 2032. That's 13 years from now. So I do 13. Now, there are two payments a year times two. Now, the I percent going down, that's what we need. The yield to maturity. Remembering, of course, that whatever we get, we have to multiply by two because we're putting in half years, so we're going to get a half year's yield out. Now we go down to the price value. In this case, right now, the price, and don't forget to put the negative, you would go 982.50. Go down to the payments. Okay, this is paying a 0.045 times 1,000 because the coupon is quoted as a percent of the face. And then don't forget to divide it by 2 because we are making the payments twice every year. Finally, don't forget, with bonds, there's always a future value of 1,000. Just make that just automatically. Don't even think. It's the only place where you do that, but with bonds, you always put 1,000 in FV. Because the future, at the end, the face value is paid. There's a kicker at the end. Those lenders get back their $1,000. Now make sure that you got below that 1-1 and the PMT is on end, not beginning. You go back up to the I percent, take the cursor back up, and just say alpha solve. And again, you put in half year. You get out half year, so you have to run the cursor over to the end and just say times 2 and drop the cursor down. There is the current yield, 4.68% on it. That is the R sub D. In other words, if the company were to go out right now and raise more money in the same manner it did as those 2030 bonds it issued in 2012, the coupon would have to be 4.68% to get $1,000 out of them. So in this case, I would get the R sub D
to get the debt costs after taxes, I would take this 4.68% times 1 minus 0.21. And that would give me my after-tax costs of debt. So I'll go back out here, 4.68%, second quit. 4.68% times, open parenthesis, 1 minus 0.21, and I would get 3.70%. Rounded to two decimal places. Yeah. Again, this coupon, let me come back in here. The apps finance, I'll come back in here. You see the coupon, that tells how much the payment is as a percent of the face value. Since the face value is always 1,000, I would take the coupon 0.045 times 4.5% times $1,000. And then I would divide it by 2 because I get the payments semi-annually. So in other words, it's actually a $45 payment a year, but it'll be divided into 2 pieces, so each 6 months you'll get $2,250. Yeah. Just stop me. Whenever you want to ask this, just make this sort of one of your routines that you're fully comfortable with. That'll get you a lot, that'll help you a lot on future quizzes and on the final exam, just to be able to push the numbers in and get the answers out. Let me tell you something real quick. I mentioned how that Tax Act, watch this. Suppose that I had done the same thing when the top marginal tax rate for this company was 39%. I would have taken the 4.68% times 1 minus 0.39, and look at that. The cost of debt would have been only 2.85%. So cutting these corporations' taxes had this backwash effect that it actually made the cost after-tax cost of debt and therefore the whole weighted average cost of capital higher than it was before. Odd little side effect, the law of unintended consequences and all of that. But there you go. That's kind of an odd little thing to note. I will point out to you that odds makers put the change in the White House in the election at probably about 75%, and the Senate flipping to the other party at about 60%. So there is, if that happens, that tax rate is going to go right back up. Might even go up above where it was before. That 39% will be the good old days if the Congress and the White House are in a very bad mood and they really want to get corporations to help pay off this massive, these budget deficits we're running. So that will change almost assuredly if we have a change in control of Washington. If control in Washington, even in the Senate, if the Senate holds, then that will stay. But if both houses go to the other party and the White House goes up, changes, that will go through the roof. So always remember, this taxes do matter to our business calculations and our business calculus in general. Okay, let me take that off the board here for a little bit and go with equity. Before I go on, I do need to mention something because I'll just keep talking about it over and over again. You, sir, I used to be a rainmaker, okay? You know what a rainmaker is? You're good. He's good. Give him a cookie. Now, shut up, okay? It's a person who brings money from external sources. I wasn't the rainmaker. I worked with the rainmakers. I was just the respectable financial analyst who was supporting what was going on. But you see, a company would come and say, we need to raise $10 million. Now, do I look like the kind of person who does things for free, like raise $10 million from very dangerous people? No. You wouldn't either. But you come to me and you say, I need $10 million. And I say, do you care where it comes from? And you say, no. Good. We'll make this happen. If you said yes, then it would be even harder. But one way or the other, I need to be paid to raise money for you. That's just how it works. Okay, do we accept that part of it? So in other words, when a company needs to bring money into the company, it has to pay for that. Like I said, you sell a product, that product doesn't come to you for free, the pieces don't come to you for free. It's going to cost you to make a product to bring money to the bottom line as internally generated equity. Okay? Same is true if you need to raise new money from outside sources, debt or equity, you're going to have to spend money to get money in. Now, some companies would say, well, we'll raise the money ourselves. Yes, I did help companies that wanted to do that. Okay, you're going to go try to sell stock to your mom and dad, to your relatives, your other relatives, to your friends' relatives, to your relatives' friends. You're going to spend hours and hours hawking this stock of yours. Yes, you're going to do that. The opportunity cost of your time is going to kill you. And then, let's take the other part of it. You might very well make a mistake that breaks a law or that some ambitious state regulatory idiot claims break the law, was a law violation of law or regulation. And then you're going to end up paying fines. You might even end up going to prison, which did happen back in my time in a couple of cases. You're going to run a risk. Yeah, you should have gone with an investment banker, but they charge, yeah, they do. But at the same time, then you don't do it yourself and nearly kill yourself trying to raise the money. And you also don't run the risk of personally making mistakes that some idiot prosecutor turns into the worst violation in human history, and you go off to prison and your company is taken away from you and your technology magically shows up at another company a few years later. And yes, that did happen to me. I saw wonderful technology, two technologies in my time in the 1990s. They regulators just found why they had raised money illegally themselves, and then those companies disappeared and thank me, Jesus, those technologies showed up later. One of them, a company had invented this weird thing. It was a tablet. A person could sign a name on it, and the name could be electronically transmitted. Oh, you use that every day. But that company's not around. Oh, that's right. That company disappeared, but somehow that technology showed back up again. I saw a company in the early 1990s, that was able to make floating holograms, three-dimensional holograms that would just float in space in front of you. They made a mistake in their way they offered stock, and they all went to prison. That technology had vanished. Even the equipment disappeared from up in this storefront in suburban Akron, Ohio. And it's showing up now, of all things, magically. But anyway, okay. So you go with an investment banker. Well, that's going to cost you a lot of money. They're going to take out a percentage or a dollar amount from each share that they sell. So if you're going to get, your price of your stock is $50. So we're going to sell a million shares at $50 each. Okay, but the problem is that the investment bankers are going to keep a cut of that $50 per share. It might be $4, $6, might be $10. So in other words, you are going to, whenever you issue new paper to raise capital, it's going to carry with it a burden that will make it more expensive than it looks. Because, for example, with a private equity firm, one of the things that they'll do is they'll say, oh, you're in trouble. Oh, you need, what is it? $100 million. Boy, that's a lot of money. Oh, we can do it, yeah. Of course, if we don't do it, your company's going to die. And it's going to die within 6 months. So what do you want to do here? Do you want to let that happen, or do you want to put us in charge? Oh, please, you do this for us? Oh, yes, we'll do this. Okay, we're going to raise $140 million. And you'll have your $100 million. Wait, you're going to raise, what you said, $140? Yeah, oh, well, $40 million is our fee. Plus, we'll want a lot of stock in your company. Okay. Yeah, okay. Good enough. If you're desperate enough, you're going to say yes. This is how private equity works, private equity firms work. You're going to be crawling out of a $140 million hole with $100 million. You ain't going to make it. Guarantee you, you're going to do okay for a while, and then you're going to be desperate. We need more. Okay, how much more? 20 million. Okay, we're going to we'll raise 25 million for you. Oh, by the way, we want new consulting agreements for this new round phase. Oh, yeah, sure, anything. Every round of that blow that you suck in guarantees you that you're going to die somewhere down the line. Sears is a good example. These private equity firms run by people like Lambert, Romney, guys like that, they'll do it for you, and then when you finally die, well, they've already pumped your stock up, so they sold their stock in your company, driving the stock price down, driving your cost of capital up. That makes you even worse off, and then you can't pay your interest payments, so they drag you into bankruptcy, and then they liquidate your company and sell the pieces of it to their friends. Welcome to capitalism, USA style. And yes, that's perfectly okay. Don't take any judgment. Don't hate. Anyway, flotation costs. They are there, and they cause the cost of new capital, debt and equity, to be more than it looks like. Now, with debt, the flotation cost is actually pretty low. With preferred stock, it's actually pretty low. As a matter of fact, the float on debt and preferred equity are low enough that we can kind of ignore those most of the time. I mean, usually in this class, I will ignore them. You know, worry about the float only when you're raising new common stock, money through new common stock. But anyway, here you go. That's the cost of debt. Now, one thing I should point out, just as a quick side here, debt is an awfully wide term. It's better if you think about the cost of short-term debt and the cost of long-term debt, because they won't be the same. If a company has, let's say, some like notes, 5-year notes, and then it has the rest of its debt is 30-year bonds, those two are going to carry different coupons, and they're probably going to carry different yields to maturity, simply because there's more risk of maturity risk premium in a long bond. There's more default premium in a long bond, things like that. So you might want to keep in mind that there is a short-term debt cost and a long-term debt cost. And so when we talk about the cost of debt, R sub D, we probably would want to break it down. That would be the weighted average of the short and long paper. Let me show you an example. It's not hard. Just trust me, this isn't bad. BNR has $40 million in short-term debt.
debt with a yield to maturity of 4.75% and 80 million in long-term debt with a current yield to maturity of 6.50%. All you do is just do a weighted average. In other words, the overall after-tax cost of the debt would be the weight of the short-term debt times the after-tax cost of the short-term debt plus the weight of the long-term debt times the after-tax cost of the long-term debt. This is definitely one of those formulas that's more complicated than doing it. Trust me on this. Look. The weight, short term, the weight, well, let's see. Short term, 40 million, long term, 180 million, total debt outstanding is 120 million. Nothing like that. So the weight of the debt would be 40 for the short term would be 40 over 120 million, and the weight of the long term would be 80 over 120 million. That's all you do for the weights, and the rest of it's just kind of like it's long, but it's just arithmetic. All you do is say the overall cost of debt would be the weight of the short term, which is 40 over 120 times the after-tax cost, 4.75% times 1 minus 0.21, plus the weight of the long-term, 80 over 120 times the 6.50% times 1 minus 0.21. Just a weighted average is all it is. You just take the each component's cost after taxes and just go from there. Now, putting that into your calculator, so you'll have that if you want to check your results later yourself from your notes. I do open parenthesis 40 over 120, close the parenthesis, times, what was that, 4.75%. times, open parenthesis, 1 minus 0.21, close the parenthesis, plus, now the weight of the long term, open parenthesis, was 80 over 120, close the parenthesis, times the, what was that, 6.5, times, open parenthesis, 1 minus 0.21, close the parenthesis, enter, 4.67%. So the weight that you would use for the cost of debt, the whole after-tax cost of debt, would be simply 4.67%. That's all. It's just a weighted average. I mean, Excel could do this even faster. Just don't forget. Yeah. Say it again.
Can you repeat the components?
Okay.
You have the weight of the short-term debt, which in this case would be $40 million of $120 million. Okay? Then you have, at times, the yield to maturity on short-term debt, which was 4.75%. And then to make it after taxes, you would take it 1 minus the tax rate. Okay? Now, the same thing again. With the weight here, 80 million of a total of 120 million is its weight, times the yield to maturity on the long debt would be 6.50%, and then again, to make it after taxes, you take 1 minus 0.21. Absolutely. I mean, this is one where, yeah, go ahead. Okay. You know what? It irritates the heck out of me that someone asks that every time. Okay, technically, when you're doing arithmetic, you always use decimals. You don't use percentages, right? Okay. Here, I can, as long as I do only the percentage itself of the cost as the percentage, I will get out a percentage. Did you notice that I did the same thing when I calculated discount rates with the capital asset pricing model? Well, you can do a percentage if all you do is that to one thing and everything else is a decimal. Like the 40 over 120 is going to be a decimal. The 21% tax rate is going to be a decimal. But as long as I do that to everything else, I can put in the yield as percentages, and what that will do is cause my answer to come out as a percentage. Okay, think about it this way. Okay, you're my kid, okay? You're still a toddler. You know, you don't like the spinach, okay? And you don't like let's just stick to spinach. Okay, Junior, that's right. I named you after myself. Junior, will you, if you eat your spinach, you can have a cookie. But if you don't eat your spinach, you have to have the ingredients to the cookie. Here, open your mouth. Here's the wheat flour. Oh, you're gluten-free? Sorry. Bad diet for tonight. Ha ha ha. Okay. And here's the sugar. Oh, having a hard time breathing? You like sugar? Here it is. Okay, and here are some really strange chemicals that I can't even pronounce. Let's take those down. Open wide. See, if you just eat your spinach, then you can have a cookie. If you just use the decimals everywhere else, you can have the cookie of a percentage. Okay. He's beginning to pull back like this, right? Okay. Where the hell was I? Okay, enough of that. Now, equity. Two large flavors of equity are the, you might think, well, that's preferred in common. No. The equity, the big two are the internally generated equity and the externally generated. In other words, how much money do you bring in to your shareholders from actually selling something? That's internally generated. That's your operating capital. Then, but that quite... very realistically, if you've got giant capital projects, there's no way your earnings from year to year are going to be able to pay for the whole thing. So you're going to have to bring in money from external sources. And sometimes that will be from selling stock to new owners. So in other words, the internally generated is your over the long haul. You obviously are going to survive only if you can make a profit. But in a shorter term, sometimes your profit isn't going to be able to pay for what you need to do. So there's that side of it. Now, the internally generated, these are two costs. Now, actually, the externally generated is going to be more costly than the internally generated. And it has to do with those flotation costs I was talking about previously. But there are two ways that you can get the equity, the cost of equity. Now, these costs, remember, in finance, we really talk about costs as percentages. Just like debt, I'm talking about costs, but I'm bringing out percentages. That's how it always is. Costs for us are percentages. You notice even when I do ratio analysis, I don't care about actual numbers. I care about percentages. Okay, internally generated. There are two ways you can do it. A really great way is to just use the stupid capital asset pricing model. The cost of a share of common stock is going to be the risk-free rate plus the beta of the stock times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. That was the capital asset pricing model. I mean, that'll get you the cost of capital every time. The problem would be, what if the company doesn't have a beta? Suppose it's too new, too young to have a beta. Or suppose that the company's a private company. It wouldn't have a beta. Now, you can probably, the best way to do that is to use comparables. You find companies that are in the same line of business that do have betas, and you take some kind of an average of those betas as the beta for your company. That'd probably be the way that is the way I've handled it. When I don't have a beta on a company, I did it that way. As a matter of fact, last spring, there was a couple of the ministries from countries in West Africa came over here for crash courses because they wanted to know if it was worth using government money to invest in these private companies to help them grow and then release them down the road. And obviously, in order to analyze the present value of future expected cash flows from these private companies, you had to have a discount rate to apply. And without the discount, without a beta, they didn't have betas, so using the CAPM was a matter of figuring out what beta would this company have if it were public. And the idea of comparables was a little bit dodgy because, I mean, yeah, there were companies like this in the United States, companies that are public, companies I could get their betas on. Would I take an average of the betas of American companies and use that for this private company in a West African country? That was a little dodgy, but, you know, honestly, they didn't know what I was doing, so I said, yeah, let's do this. Okay, the other way is to back end using the old dividend growth model. You remember how we could price a stock? Remember that the price of a share of common stock right now, of a share of common stock, would be the dividend one period out over the discount rate you would use minus the growth rate, where the dividend was one period out was the current dividend times 1 plus G. Okay, see that formula? I showed you that. We did that. I can actually algebraically twist that around. And I'm not going to do it because, you know what? In the class this morning, I tried to turn this formula around to solve for the R sub CS, and I screwed it up. Yeah. As I've said before, don't get old. Finish it before you get to embarrass yourself. Okay, now, I can actually solve for the common stock. Just rearranging this formula, it comes out that the cost of common stock equity, if you do it this way, is the dividend one period out divided by the price now and all of that plus the growth rate. You do it, you'll see it comes out. It works. If you algebraically rearrange it. So in other words, I could find the cost of common stock this way.
Or, and this is the second way, I could do the dividend one period out divided by the price of the stock right now minus G. Oh, minus G. Divided by the price of the stock, and then that whole fraction plus G.
Problem with it. Obviously, if this company doesn't pay a dividend, you got nothing. You're back to the cap out. The second thing is more interesting. I can't tell you how many times I had companies. We'd have a board meeting, and I would say, all right, the stock price has dropped quite a bit. We got to get something done about this. And this question they were earnest. Well, why do we care if the stock price fell? We already sold the stock. They're going to be irritated at the next shareholder meeting, but you know, what does that have to do with us? Explaining to them, when the stock price drops, that means the entire D1 over P0 goes up. So the stock price is inversely related to the cost of equity capital, which means that the price of the stock going down causes the whole weighted average cost of capital to elevate. Explaining that, though, was really a painful thing. They don't see it. They don't feel it. It's, again, one of those opportunity cost things. The company officials, the board of directors, don't feel the effect of that eroding stock price as it erodes the company through creating more costly capital. Not right away, anyway. Okay, now, the externally generated. It's actually not nearly as hard as you might think. Because all that happens is that if you're selling new common stock, they take a shaving off the price. So you don't get $50 a share, for example. You get $50 minus the float. So the cost of the externally generated from this dividend growth formula would simply be R sub new stock would be D1 over the price minus how much you pay in the float, all plus G. You just take out the float, which obviously makes it, you've got P0, and then you subtract something from it, you've got a smaller number in the denominator. That's why new equity is more costly than existing equity, because you are spending money to get those new shareholders. You don't have to spend money on your existing shareholders, but if you want new ones, you have to spend money. You, sir, are you married? You will be. Okay, once you are married, it's Denny's, macaroni and cheese, generic from Hy-Vee, you know, the whole nine yards. But on the way there, in order to induce a relationship, it's Tony Roma's, it's Biagi's, it's indeed Jim's Steakhouse, okay? And you understand. You have to spend money to bring in someone new. It's exactly the same way. You're thinking to yourself, I ain't spending that kind of money. I'm just good looking. No, you will. Okay? You see, that's just the thing. If anything you do, you're going to have to spend money to draw money. When I sell my artwork, I'm just about to put down a hell of a lot of money to Amazon to do a marketing campaign, because I'm not going to sell anything if I don't have people know about it. And the same is true in any company. And so it's true when you raise capital. Now, the thing of it is, preferred. I should mention preferred. I do the same dirty trick with preferred that I did with the dividend growth model. Remember when I showed you that the price of preferred stock is going to be that flat dividend over the cost of the preferred, over the discount rate. That's how you do it. You can look back in your notes. I did it that way. That is a flat, no growth stock price. That's how preferred stock works. All I have to do is rearrange it, and I get the cost of preferred stock is going to be the flat dividend over the current price of the preferred. That's all you do. Now, you want to include a float, you just do that's existing. If you want to include new, this is existing preferred. If you want to do the same thing with new preferred, you can do it just like I did over there and say that it's D over price of the preferred right now minus the float. Like I said, that float is not severe at all, or at least historically. It's been quite small. Oftentimes in the past in this class and in classes similar to it, I said just ignore the difference between existing and new preferred because that float really doesn't do much. Look, if you're selling preferred at $50 and your float is 1%, that's $50 minus 50 cents, 49.50. Really doesn't cause a lot of difference like it does with common stock where your float can be 4, 6, 8, 10%. Or a lot of times even a lot worse than that. So you keep that in mind. What I'll do on the Thursday is I'll just do a bunch of examples, mostly just examples. For now, however, I'm going to give you a quiz, and once you're finished with the quiz, that'll be all I have for you, and I thank you.